November 18th, 1970, Nashville, Indiana. A barn located on the property of 52-year-old Clarence Roberts burns to the ground, and his charred body is found in the rubble. However, since Clarence was experiencing financial problems at the time, there is skepticism that the body actually belongs to him, and insurance companies refuse to pay out on a policy for Clarence's wife, Geneva. 10 years later, Geneva Roberts is killed in a mysterious house fire, alongside a man who was positively identified as her supposedly deceased husband, Clarence. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I will be covering one of the oddest cases ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the death of Clarence and Geneva Roberts. Or should I say the deaths of Clarence Roberts, because this guy apparently died twice. This is a really bizarre tale of a man who was supposedly killed in a fire in 1970, and then seemingly rose from the dead to be killed in another fire 10 years later, only this time, it also claimed the life of his wife, Geneva. It's one of those stories that you couldn't possibly dream up if you tried, and if a work of fiction contained a plot with all the twists and turns featured here, you'd probably groan and roll your eyes over how contrived and unbelievable it was. But all of this stuff really happened. There are some aspects of this mystery where it seems pretty obvious what happened, but other aspects will leave you scratching your head. One of the reasons I chose to cover this case now is because I was in Indianapolis for CrimeCon 2 weeks ago. Nashville, Indiana is about an hour away from Indianapolis, and this remains one of the state's most baffling mysteries. And it turns out that another prominent podcast felt the exact same way. When I arrived at CrimeCon, I finally got to meet Joe, Steve, and Devin, the anonymous hosts of the hugely popular Thinking Sideways podcast. They immediately took me out to lunch, and after spending a large chunk of the weekend hanging out with them, I do not have enough words to describe how awesome they are. But get this, the Thinking Sideways crew did a live recording of an episode in front of an audience at CrimeCon, and guess which case they covered? The deaths of Clarence and Geneva Roberts. Yes, they seem to have the exact same idea I did about selecting an Indiana-based mystery for the occasion, and I guess it's only appropriate that this case took place in the town of Nashville, Indiana, while next year's CrimeCon will take place in Nashville, Tennessee. But I just want to clarify that the majority of this episode was already recorded and in the can before I left for CrimeCon, so this is all just an amazing coincidence. Great podcasting minds think alike, I guess. But before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and shorter mini-sodes. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new mini-sode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it and leave us a rating or a review, because that will help us garner more exposure. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on our website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now chronicle the deaths of Clarence and Geneva Roberts. Our story begins in 1970 in the small town of Nashville, Indiana. Our central figures are 52-year-old Clarence Roberts and his 49-year-old wife, Geneva. Clarence is one of the most popular and well-respected residents in the community, whose accomplishments include serving a term as sheriff of Brown County and working as director of the Nashville State Bank. Clarence and one of his brothers, Carson, were also very prosperous businessmen, partnering up to form their own successful lumber business and hardware store in the town. Clarence and Geneva have been married for 29 years, and the couple have 4 sons. Before her marriage, Geneva came from a relatively poor background, but the couple would enjoy a comfortable middle-class lifestyle. However, by the late 1960s, Clarence would reach the point where he wanted to live the life of a wealthy millionaire, so he decided to sell off his interest in his lumber business and hardware store, and use the capital to invest in an apartment building and several grain elevators. Clarence also used the money to purchase a large new house and 3 luxury cars. Unfortunately for Clarence, his investments went belly up, as a flood sabotaged the construction of his new apartment building. This caused him to fall heavily into debt and made it impossible for him to maintain his upper-class lifestyle. In fact, another one of Clarence's brothers, Warren Roberts, happened to be Brown County Sheriff at this time, and he had to go through the incredibly awkward ordeal of repossessing 2 of Clarence's luxury cars for non-payment. If that wasn't enough, the $25,000 mortgage on Clarence's new home had defaulted, and he was up to his eyeballs in civil court cases. He had taken out a 6-figure loan for the construction of the apartment building, and was now facing allegations of fraud for submitting phony expense claims to collect the money. Clarence's debt totaled around $200,000, and he was on the verge of complete financial ruin, but things would take an unexpected turn on the evening of November 18th, when a barn on his rural property, which was ordinarily used as a garage, caught fire. The building burned to the ground, and when the fire department arrived at the scene and searched the rubble, they discovered the charred body of a man who had been burned beyond recognition. He was missing both of his arms and legs, which were believed to have completely burned off, and a half-melted 16-gauge shotgun was on top of his body. The state fire marshal would determine that an accelerant had been used to start the fire deliberately. Since Geneva and her sons were not home at the time the fire took place, it was initially assumed that the victim was Clarence, and that he'd set fire to the barn, and then shot himself in order to take his own life. Clarence had purchased multiple life insurance policies which would pay out a total of $1.2 million to Geneva upon his death. In fact, one of Clarence's attorneys would claim that he once used the words, "My widow will be the richest one in Brown County." Hours before the fire took place, a bank officer had stopped off at the Roberts residence because he believed Clarence had forged his brother Carson's signature on a note used to obtain a $7,500 loan, but Clarence never answered the door. So the obvious explanation was that Clarence had committed suicide in order to escape his financial troubles and was hoping the insurance money would provide for his family. However, there were a number of strange inconsistencies from the fire scene which troubled investigators. In spite of the presence of a shotgun, no trace of a wound could be found anywhere on Clarence's body. It was ultimately determined that the cause of death was carbon monoxide poisoning. Clarence's pickup truck had been in the barn and survived the fire, and there were over 30 holes in the exhaust system, which would have caused a massive leakage of carbon monoxide. So could Clarence have expired before he had the chance to pull the trigger? Well, the big problem was that there was a lot of evidence to indicate the body might not actually be Clarence. A tooth was found in the rubble which was identified as being a second lower right molar, but Clarence had that particular molar extracted 6 years earlier. When x-rays were taken of the victim, there were a number of mismatches with Clarence's x-rays. The victim only had one kidney, even though there was no record of Clarence ever having surgery to remove a kidney in his life. More alarm bells were raised when blood samples were taken from the victim, and his blood type turned out to be AB, but Clarence's medical records showed that his blood type was B. Clarence was also a member of the 33rd degree of the Masons, and when investigators searched the rubble in the days following the fire, they discovered his Masonic ring, which had his name inscribed on it. However, the big issue was that there was no sign of heat or fire damage on the ring, and it still looked to be in pristine condition. This fire was supposed to be hot enough to burn all of Clarence's limbs to ash, yet his ring came out unscathed? In addition, Clarence's wedding ring could not be found anywhere in the ashes. There was a lot of suspicion that the Masonic ring was planted at the scene after the fact, in an attempt to lend more credence to the idea that Clarence was the victim. Well, a lot of people weren't buying it, and one of the biggest skeptics was Clarence's own brother, Warren, whom, as you'll recall, was Brown County Sheriff. In spite of this, Clarence's wife and son seemed to have no trouble believing that he died in the fire, and held a funeral for him and buried his body 3 days later. Well, things got even more suspicious when witnesses reported seeing Clarence in the nearby town of Morgantown with an unidentified man 2 days before the fire. This man appeared to be an intoxicated vagrant who was kicked out of a liquor store and fell onto the sidewalk, but Clarence just happened to pass by him and brought him into a nearby tavern to buy him a meal and a drink. As they were leaving, the man keeled over and appeared to be suffering from a seizure, so Clarence put him in his car and told concerned witnesses that he was going to take him to a hospital. However, this would turn out to be the last time anyone ever saw this man. Investigators checked all hospitals within a 300-mile radius, but could find no record that this guy had ever been there. It's also worth noting that the only remnant of clothing found on the body after the fire was a portion of a brown plaid shirt. About an hour before the fire took place, Clarence was seen wearing a plain blue shirt, but witnesses who saw the vagrant in Morgantown remembered him wearing a brown plaid shirt. So 1 month after Clarence's burial, his body was exhumed and sent to Indianapolis for additional testing, but no conclusive evidence could be found to prove that he was Clarence. It started to seem more and more likely that Clarence had faked his own death by murdering someone else and burning their body beyond recognition. So the county actually refused to return the body to Clarence's grave, and he was instead buried in another grave under a marker which read John Doe, though the grave eventually became unmarked when someone stole the marker. In December of 1975, a Brown County grand jury actually went so far as to indict Clarence for murder and kidnapping, but the problem was that no one could actually find him. Over the years, there would be unconfirmed sightings of Clarence throughout Indiana, and even one from a witness who claimed he saw Clarence eating at a restaurant in Mexico. Interestingly enough, a tavern owner claimed to have seen Clarence with an unidentified woman in his establishment several times before his death, but he also saw them together after his death in April of 1972. But even though there was no definitive proof that Clarence was dead, there was no definitive proof that he was still alive either. Well, understandably, when the insurance companies heard about all this, they refused to pay out the $1.2 million from Clarence's life insurance policies to Geneva. This led to a long, drawn-out legal battle which lasted the entire decade, as Geneva managed to find a couple of attorneys who were willing to take her case even though she could not afford to pay them. In 1977, Geneva attempted to petition the courts to declare Clarence legally dead, but they refused. So she filed suit against the insurance companies in hopes of finally collecting the money from the policies, and they eventually went to a civil trial. Her attorneys hired respected criminal pathologist Dr. John Pless to examine the body, and he would testify that he believed the body did belong to Clarence. However, the defendants countered with their own testimony from a physical anthropologist who believed that the victim's arms and legs did not just burn off in the fire, and that there were traces of blade marks on his limbs to indicate that he was dismembered beforehand. So obviously, how could Clarence have dismembered each of his limbs before he committed suicide? The court also heard about all of Clarence's financial problems and misdeeds prior to his death. One witness even testified that in September of 1970, Clarence had shown him a card for a secret Swiss bank account which he claimed had more than $100,000 in it. In May of 1979, Geneva's lawsuit was officially dismissed, as the trial judge ruled that there was insufficient evidence to prove that Clarence Roberts was actually dead. In addition to not receiving the insurance money, Geneva was also ordered to pay the court costs for both sides, even though she was destitute by that point. But there was a lot more weirdness surrounding Geneva. Since Clarence's life insurance policies never paid out, Geneva lost everything and was reduced to poverty again, so she was forced to take a job as a dishwasher at a restaurant and moved into a small trailer home located 6 miles outside of Nashville. She essentially became a reclusive social outcast, but there was still a lot of gossip surrounding her. On multiple occasions throughout the decade, there would be sightings of an unidentified man on Geneva's property. No one would ever get a good glimpse at him, as whenever someone noticed him walking around outside the house, he would quickly go back inside. If anyone showed up at the house to visit Geneva, she would always greet them on the porch, but never invited them inside. She always kept the shades drawn at her house, and even had her own attack dog to prevent trespassers on her property. The local shopkeepers also took note of the fact that Geneva was constantly purchasing large quantities of beer, even though she was a diabetic and almost never drank. Of course, there was speculation that Geneva had a secret boyfriend, but since no one ever got a good look at this mysterious man hanging around her property, and it seemed like he was going out of his way to avoid being seen, rumors started circulating that the supposedly deceased Clarence Roberts had returned to Nashville and was hiding out in Geneva's house. Well, a lot of people always suspected that Geneva was a co-conspirator in her husband's so-called death, so once the rumor spread that Clarence might be back in town, police decided to put surveillance on Geneva's house for 3 days. However, they never saw Clarence, nor any other man for that matter. Clarence's sister Dolly happened to live in a trailer on an adjacent property, and she attempted to refute these rumors. She admitted to overhearing a man converse with Geneva on multiple occasions, but even though she never actually saw him, Dolly maintained that this guy's voice wasn't Clarence's. Anyway, Geneva filed an appeal after losing her lawsuit, but it was dismissed by the Indiana Court of Appeals on October 15, 1980. They ruled that Geneva would have to provide concrete proof that Clarence was dead if she wanted any hope of overturning the verdict and collecting on the insurance policies. Well, a month and a half later, on the evening of November 29th, another shocking twist occurred. That night, Geneva's home caught fire and burned to the ground. When the flames were doused, two bodies were found in the rubble. One of them was identified as Geneva Roberts, who had been lying on her cot. The other body belonged to a male, and, well, you guessed it, he was eventually identified as Clarence Roberts. The cause of death for both of them was determined to be smoke inhalation, and it turned out that arson was involved, as someone had used an accelerant to start the fire, spreading it from the bedroom to the house's back door. While many members of Clarence's family refused to believe that the body belonged to him, they were willing to claim Geneva's body and pay for a funeral and her burial, but they refused to do the same thing for her male companion, maintaining that Clarence had already died 10 years earlier. They pushed forward the idea that the man who died in this fire might have been Geneva's mysterious boyfriend. However, in an ironic twist, Dr. John Pless, the same pathologist who testified on Geneva's behalf at her civil trial and claimed that the man who died in the fire in 1970 was Clarence, he publicly admitted that he had been wrong. When he looked at the x-rays from the male victim in the 1980 fire, they looked awfully familiar, since he had already spent a great deal of time studying Clarence Roberts' x-rays. When Pless compared them, he found them to be a complete match. The teeth from this victim also matched Clarence's dental records. So Dr. Pless held a press conference alongside a dentist and a physical anthropologist, and they all conclusively identified the victim of the second fire as Clarence Roberts. In spite of this, Clarence's family still refused to claim his body, so Brown County now had to pick up the tab of giving him a proper burial. So the body of the victim from the second fire is currently buried underneath a headstone for Clarence Roberts, while the body of the victim from the first fire is buried in an unmarked grave somewhere, even though many members of the Roberts family maintain that both victims are buried in the wrong place. Confused yet? Well, when the case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in December of 1988, some of the family members were interviewed on the show, and you could tell there were very divisive reactions about what happened. One of Clarence's nephews was still insistent that he died in the first fire back in 1970, while Clarence's sister-in-law expressed her belief that he was still alive and hiding out somewhere. Whatever the case, the full circumstances behind what actually happened are still unclear, and if someone else was responsible for murdering Clarence and Geneva in 1980, their identity is unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Well, I know that the concept of faking your own death in order to collect the insurance money is a popular trope in fiction, but this sounds like one of the all-time craziest real-life examples. In spite of what his surviving family members may have thought, I'd say there's virtually no chance that Clarence Roberts died in the first fire in 1970. It's interesting to look at this case from a modern perspective, as certain aspects of this mystery would be solved in a heartbeat today. But there was no DNA testing back in 1970, and forensics were nowhere near as advanced as they are right now. However, the fact that the victim had an entirely different blood type than Clarence, and that nothing about his body matched him in any way whatsoever, that should rule out the possibility that he was Clarence. And when you consider all the public sightings of Clarence with a vagrant just 2 days before the fire, and that this vagrant was never seen again, I think it's perfectly obvious the body belonged to this man, and that Clarence staged the scene in order to fake his own death. Now, I will give Clarence the benefit of the doubt and consider the possibility that maybe he did not actually kill this man himself. The vagrant was seen collapsing and appeared to be suffering from some sort of seizure before Clarence drove him away from the scene. Given that he did not appear to be in the best of health, I guess it's not impossible that the man could have died of natural causes while in Clarence's care, but instead of calling the authorities, Clarence used this opportunity to dream up a scheme in which he torched the vagrant's body and faked his own death. However, I do think there's enough evidence to suggest that Clarence murdered this man. The cause of death was believed to be carbon monoxide poisoning, and there were 30 holes in the exhaust system of Clarence's truck which was found in the barn. Clarence might not have had the stomach to inflict any violence on the vagrant, so while he was passed out or unconscious, Clarence probably placed him in the truck's cab, sabotaged the exhaust system, and then started the truck until the victim expired from carbon monoxide poisoning. I can see why some of Clarence's family members continue to maintain that he died in the first fire, because if he didn't, that would mean he's a murderer, and nobody wants to accept that a family member is capable of that, especially when they've been a well-liked, well-respected citizen for most of their life. However, I think it speaks volumes that the one family member who was skeptical about the whole thing was Clarence's brother, Warren, the county sheriff. Since Warren personally repossessed Clarence's vehicles, he probably believed that the guy who was capable of getting in way over his head with financial fraud was also capable of committing murder if he was desperate enough. Warren was deceased by the time the Unsolved Mysteries segment was filmed, but his widow, Alberta, was interviewed, and she clearly didn't think too highly of Clarence, and had no trouble believing that he was a murderer, though I would disagree with her assessment that Clarence faked his own death twice and was still alive somewhere. What strikes me about Clarence's scheme was how badly planned it really was. If Clarence wanted to plant a shotgun on the vagrant's body in order to give off the impression that he committed suicide, then maybe he should have actually, you know, fired a shot into his body, as the lack of a gunshot wound was one of the first things to raise eyebrows and give off the impression that something wasn't right. I guess Clarence's reasoning for cutting off the victim's limbs was to get rid of potential fingerprint evidence, but that only made investigators more suspicious about why all his limbs were burnt into ash when the rest of his body was intact. Clarence, or whoever else might have been involved, also got a bit too clever for their own good when they decided to plant his Masonic ring in the ashes after the fire took place, as investigators tend to get skeptical when an item is found at the scene of a fire but has no actual fire damage. So obviously, the big mystery here is, if the victim wasn't Clarence, who was he? Well, obviously, it had to be the vagrant Clarence was seen with, but we still don't know his true identity. Investigators attempted to figure out who he was and uncovered a few promising candidates. In 1974, he was publicly identified as a St. Louis man named John Coopsey, but that was refuted when Coopsey was discovered to be alive. In 1981, investigators looked into the possibility that the vagrant was an alcoholic drifter from Kentucky named James Woodrow Hatcher, whose relatives had not seen him since the late 1960s. However, a comparison of Hatcher's x-rays to the victim's x-rays did not match, and I have no idea if the real James Woodrow Hatcher was ever found. I guess the big obstacle with identifying this man is that he was a vagrant, so I'm not sure if he had any family or friends who would have reported him missing. As far as I can tell, this John Doe does not even have a profile on the Doe Network right now. I've mentioned before on this podcast that a lot of cases involving John and Jane Does have been solved within the past few years. When they're finally identified, it often turns out the victim had left home and just broke off contact with their family and friends. Since they were never officially reported missing, they remained unidentified for decades. That's probably the case with this vagrant, but given that nearly 50 years have passed, I'm not sure if he would have had any next of kin left to identify him or claim his body. But the one thing we do know is that this man was definitely not Clarence Roberts, and the evidence seems pretty conclusive that Clarence was killed in the second fire in 1980. So here's where the murky part of this story begins. What exactly was Clarence doing during the 10-year period he was missing? Well, it seems pretty obvious that Clarence was hoping everyone would just believe he was dead and that Geneva would receive over $1 million in insurance benefits. After she collected the money, Geneva would then rejoin her husband somewhere, and they'd both disappear and start a new life together as millionaires. But of course, this plan went horribly wrong when the insurance companies refused to pay out, and the court sided with them. Of course, Clarence was practically bankrupt at the time he disappeared, so how exactly could he have survived during this entire 10-year period? There were unconfirmed sightings of him, one of which was in Mexico, but even if those sightings weren't accurate, I'm sure Clarence probably laid low and hid out somewhere, at least for a couple years. At the civil trial, one witness testified that Clarence had shown him a card for a Swiss bank account in which he claimed to have stashed over $100,000, and I believe there's probably some truth to that. Since Clarence was suffering from so many financial problems and committing brazen acts of fraud, I would not be surprised if he built up a secret rainy day fund for himself, stashing a bunch of money away in the event he had to run. At the time of his disappearance, Clarence's debts totaled around $200,000, so it's not like this alleged Swiss bank account money would have solved his problems. And $100,000 was probably not enough money for Clarence to live off of for the rest of his life, especially since he was accustomed to an upper-class lifestyle. So he probably hoped that Geneva's payout from the insurance companies would be enough money for him to disappear and live comfortably. However, 10 years passed, and Geneva never got paid, so it's a good bet that Clarence blew through that Swiss bank account money by the end of the decade. Therefore, he became desperate and eventually returned to Nashville to shack up with Geneva again. Now, no one ever turned up any hard evidence that Clarence had a secret Swiss bank account, but I have to think he had something stashed away, because I doubt he could have stayed off the radar for so long without financial aid. We have sightings of a man who many people believe was Clarence on Geneva's property, but it sounds like these sightings occurred in the late 70s, and there's no way Clarence could have been hiding there for 10 straight years without anyone catching on. This man at Geneva's house is definitely the oddest part of the story for me. It's pretty odd that we have all these sightings of him, but somehow, nobody manages to get a good enough look at his face to confirm if he was actually Clarence or not. I know that Clarence's sister Dolly claimed that she overheard this man's voice without actually seeing his face, and was absolutely certain that it was not Clarence's voice, but come on, consider the source. If you look at all the newspaper articles from this time period, Dolly never stops maintaining that her brother died in the first fire in 1970, so I wouldn't exactly trust her to have an objective opinion. Dolly even shared this weird story about how a man knocked on her trailer door asking her to call an ambulance for Geneva because she was sick. This man claimed he was Geneva's son, but Dolly said it didn't sound like his voice or Clarence's voice. When she opened the door, this mysterious man was nowhere to be found. Obviously, if Clarence was hiding out there, his sister would have a vested interest in covering for him. However, there was a lot of gossip around town that Geneva had a secret boyfriend, and she was known for being a very private person. So I guess it's not impossible that she really did have a boyfriend, and this man seen hanging around her property was him. But here's one part of the story I never understood. The police state they put surveillance on Geneva's house for 3 days, but never saw any man there. But is that really all they did? Remember, a grand jury actually indicted Clarence for kidnapping and murder in 1975, so he was technically a wanted fugitive. If police had probable cause to believe that Clarence was hiding out in Geneva's house, couldn't they have obtained a search warrant? Did they really not enter the house at all the entire time Geneva was living there? I don't know, there's just something about this which doesn't sit right with me. All things considered, Clarence really should not have been able to hide out at Geneva's residence for an extended period of time without being caught. So I have to wonder if Clarence started catching on to the fact that people were watching him, so he decided to skip town and hide somewhere else for a while. I really don't think it's any accident that the second fire occurred only a month and a half after Geneva lost her appeal to overturn the court's ruling that the insurance companies wouldn't have to pay her any money. I think by that point, Geneva had lost all hope of ever collecting that money. She was already destitute by this point, and if Clarence was relying on her insurance money to live out the rest of his life, then I can see how things might have gone badly. And here's a very incriminating detail which is easy to miss unless you dig deep into the newspaper articles. On the very day of the fire, a mailman delivered a registered letter to Geneva, ordering her to appear in court within the next few weeks in order to deal with lawsuits from Clarence's creditors, who were still owed money from 10 years before. So I have a feeling that that was the breaking point. Since an accelerant was used to start the fire, it's easy to believe that Clarence murdered Geneva, but the big question is, how did he die? A murder-suicide or a suicide pact is possible, because maybe they figured their sons would receive a substantial insurance payout if they both died, but would Clarence really kill himself via smoke inhalation or setting himself on fire? Well, one crucial piece of information not mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries is that a grand jury actually convened to investigate the fire in 1983. Since Clarence and Geneva both had a high blood alcohol content, they determined that Geneva likely went unconscious before the fire started, possibly because mass alcohol consumption caused her to fall into a diabetic coma. Clarence's body was found in a storage room containing solvents and other flammable liquids, so the grand jury's belief was that since he had no noticeable wounds on him, Clarence might have passed out either from his alcohol consumption or from fumes from the solvents and went up in flames. I'd say that's a pretty plausible explanation, but when the Unsolved Mysteries segment aired 5 years later, one of the investigators went on camera and stated that he believed the fire was started by an unknown third party. It's interesting that he would say that, because if the grand jury was correct, and Clarence started the fire and accidentally caused his own death, then that would close the books for good on any murder investigation. I have to wonder if the police had inside knowledge that we don't know about which made them suspect foul play. The x-rays revealed that Clarence had 2 broken ribs when he was found, but I don't know if someone broke his ribs in a violent struggle, if he might have broken them when he fell down, or if he got those injuries there long before the fire started. One possible theory is that this man seen on Geneva's property wasn't Clarence and was actually a secret boyfriend she had. When Clarence returned to see Geneva, this boyfriend then snapped and decided to kill them both and start the fire. But I don't know, there was never any hard evidence that Geneva was seeing another man during this time period, so I'm inclined to believe that the man seen on her property was Clarence. It's also worth noting that there were multiple sightings of Clarence with an unidentified woman in a tavern, both before and after his so-called death in 1970. So did Clarence have a mistress on the side? This was never definitively proven, but it would not surprise me at all if Clarence was living somewhere with a mistress on his Swiss bank account money, but then she decided to break it off with him once the money ran out. I guess this mistress could have been responsible for murdering Clarence in Geneva, but again, we have no way of knowing if she actually existed. Overall, I just don't see any strong suspects who could have killed the Robertses and burned down the house. So in spite of what that investigator might think, I'm inclined to believe there was no third party, and that Clarence murdered Geneva, started the fire, but then passed out and died. So when you look at this case as a whole, it becomes quite apparent that even though he seemed to be a very well-liked, well-respected person for most of his life, Clarence Roberts was pretty much a complete scumbag, and he was not a victim in this story. It's obvious that once he entered his 50s, he was just overcome by greed and caused his own mess with all of his bad financial decisions and fraudulent practices. He then left his wife and sons in the lurch by faking his death and disappearing, and committed at least 1, probably 2 murders in the process. I'd say there's a good chance Geneva knew what her husband was planning to do, but I still feel some sympathy towards her. This was a woman who escaped an impoverished childhood by marrying Clarence, and then got to have a family and live a solid middle-class life until her husband screwed up and caused her to lose everything. It sounds like she was a woman who might have been raised to do everything her husband told her, even if it was wrong. If Clarence actually had a secret Swiss bank account and a mistress, then he probably got to live fairly well for at least a few more years, while Geneva was reduced to poverty, which is just one more thing which makes him look incredibly scummy. And when he became desperate, Clarence came crawling back to Geneva and rewarded her loyalty by murdering her. But even if Clarence alone was responsible for everything that happened, there is still an unsolved mystery here. The real victim in this story is the poor vagrant who was murdered by Clarence, who still remains unidentified after all these years. If by chance, this man still has relatives out there looking for him, it would be nice to figure out who he is, and finally solve the last piece of the puzzle in this case. So if you happen to have any information about who the unidentified man who died in the fire in 1970 might be, or if you know that someone else was responsible for the deaths of Clarence and Geneva Roberts, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own theory about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. I just need to provide a big shout out to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. We also received a new donation this week from a listener named Heather, so thank you very much, Heather. I wanted to send out another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And I particularly want to thank History Mystery, one of the mods from that subreddit, who also attended CrimeCon and took the initiative to organize a public meetup. It was originally supposed to be a quiet gathering with myself and some of our fellow Redditors, but a whole bunch of other podcast hosts wound up joining us throughout the evening, including Joe and Steve from Thinking Sideways, Justin and Aaron from Generation Y, Allie and Charlie from Insight, Nina from Already Gone, Earthen from Beyond the Blood, and Justin from Mysterious Circumstances, along with other notable true crime figures such as James Renner, John Ronson, and Billy Jensen. It was a pretty fun night, and CrimeCon as a whole was such a great experience for me. I loved finally getting to meet my fellow podcasters, and they were all incredibly nice people who are very appreciative of their fans. And it was a joy finally getting to meet my listeners and fans, and I greatly appreciated all the positive feedback and kind words you said to me. I also had a blast performing a live reading of one of my minisodes at a private party for some of my fans, and I plan to post video footage of that very soon. So once again, a big thanks to everyone who made CrimeCon such a phenomenal experience for me. CrimeCon will be returning next year in Nashville from May 4th until the 6th, 2018, and you can bet I'll be attending, and I hope to have the chance to meet and hang out with many more of you folks. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website. So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new minisode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm